I am well. I'm so pleased to see you smiling.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government. Today is May 4th, 2017. And colleagues, today we're going to have a public on Senate Bill 5535, Department of Revenue. Let me get that opened up. And today we're going to talk about revenue management and collections. That's going to include personal tax and compliance division. We're going to be hearing from Steve and Deanna. Okay, so Madam Director, come on up, kick us off with a few words if you want to. It's your call, however you want to run this. And we'll turn this over to you. Colleagues, really quick, I have to testify on a bill very shortly. I'll be right back, and then I have to be in the governor's office at about 4:15. So I'll be running in and out. So I apologize for those disruptions.
It's that time of year.
Welcome.
Co-Chair Smith and Manning, members of the committee. Good afternoon. I'm Nia Ray. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Revenue. I will make this very quick because we have a very involved presentation for you today. I'd just like to reiterate that I certainly look forward to working with you. I know that, you know, the past few days have had some tense moments, but that's part of what we do. That's how we arrive at the results that better the experiences of Oregonians with the Department of Revenue and the state as a whole. So we certainly take that, any interaction that we have, communication that we have in that vein, and we look forward to working with you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Good afternoon, chairpersons and members of the committee. My name is Steve Bouchard, the collection section manager for the Oregon Department of Revenue.
And I'm Deanna Mack with the director's office in the Department of Revenue. And I'm here to kick off the presentation. The first thing I wanted to talk to you about is what we talk all the time about liquidated and delinquent debt. And so I thought it would be important that we talk about exactly what that means. Delinquent debt is kind of the easy part of it. It's just any debt that's past due. That's the easy part. But when we get to what liquidated debt means, generally it means that appeal rights must be expired. We've made a reasonable attempt to notify the debtor of the amount of debt that they owe, usually in our billing statements, and we've issued a distraint warrant, or they have met the prerequisites for issuing a distraint warrant, so 30 days after a written demand to pay has been filed. So usually our debt doesn't become liquidated and delinquent until about, I think it's about 90 days after it is first delinquent, is when it becomes liquidated and delinquent. So that's kind of a key component of all the conversations that we have about the liquidated and delinquent debt, so you understand where we're at. In the most recent LFO report on liquidated and delinquent debt, it shows the judicial branch debt. It also shows some executive branch debt. The Department of Revenue is the second highest in total accounts receivables outstanding out of the bulk of the 3.3 million, where in as of June 30th, 2016, the balance was about $630 million. And this is a slide that just shows, illustrates another way to show how much debt is out there. The total accounts receivable balances for the entire state as an enterprise, for all branches, is $3.3 billion. Department of Revenue has oversight for the $629 million in tax debt. That represents 20%. And then our other agency accounts collect on behalf of other agencies, and we have $334 million. About 10% of that is with DOR.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Ms. Mack, just for context, if I'm not mistaken, the general fund debt is about $800 million?
Mr. Co-Chairs and Representative Gomberg, I believe that the general fund debt is about, in the most recent LFO report, is about $633 million. So we have about 95-96% of that. The rest of it goes to smaller agencies that have very small amount of dollars. That's the most recent balance. I think it's higher than that if you were to pull the report today, but I don't know that exact number. But it does fluctuate, especially this time of year.
Obviously, we have some concerns about the difference between other funds and general fund dollars, but please. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The next slide, it just illustrates since 2007 to date, the growth and the representation of accounts receivables. The blue line represents the total state, and the orange line represents what is carried at the Department of Revenue, including all the categories that Deanna just spoke to. And as it relates to liquid and delinquent debt, not current balance sheet debt. This next slide is a basic composition of the accounts receivable with the Department of Revenue. So there's three pie charts. The first pie chart says there's three basic components, which is personal income tax that we collect on, withholding taxes that hasn't been paid to the department, and finally corporate tax that is due to collections. Within those categories, there are three components of how that debt got there. And so someone could be audited, for example, and the audit could result in a tax obligation to be paid, and that is represented in that lightest peach color that's 14%. The lighter brown color is primarily self-assessed debt. People file their taxes as they should. They recognize they have a tax obligation, but it's not paid, and it will be subject to collections. And then finally, the largest category, 50% of it, you guys have heard a lot of comments and remarks made about estimated returns or returns that are generated by the department, not the individual. And then that creates an assessment, a bill item, and therefore it ends up in the accounts receivable. And that's represented in that orange color, which is made up of half of that total figure. And finally, within those components, you have three elements. There's the basic tax, the penalty associated with the tax unpaid, as well as the interest owed on that money over time. We put this chart in here just to show an illustration of how money ends up in the receivables balance, which I said self-assessed is exactly that, a return that's processed by an individual sent to the department with a tax obligation yet to be owed. An amended return by virtue of an audit that we have done on an individual with unpaid tax obligation, a demand to file, which is requested by the department to the individual because we think they are subject to file in the state but have not, and finally, failure to file, we actually file for them. And then it ends up in receivables, and a lot of that debt is paid prior to becoming in collection status or prior to reaching that moment that it's liquid and delinquent, and therefore the final box is that piece there that's actually in collections that is on my work plate in my section.
Okay, let me ask a question, and I really don't want to put you on the spot, but this is one, you know, we talk about receivable balances and stuff. On my Facebook, an acquaintance, I worked with this man for a number of years. We served on some boards and stuff. He put out on Facebook that he had filed his state tax and his federal tax. He sent in a check. This is back in April. And the feds had cashed his check for, you know, money that he owed. He said, but he had wrote the state apparently two times, and none of the checks have cashed. So I'm not... How widespread does that happen, or because that seems like an issue when people go to Facebook mm-hmm. and start saying that, hey, I paid my state taxes, but they haven't cashed my check. This has been over a month ago. Mm. The feds cashed my check. I sent it off at the same time, and I sent them two letters. So how does that happen? And potentially, how widespread is this? Could that, I mean, keep your books off balance if you have money and it's not processed? And
Mr. Co-Chair, that, I believe, is an anomaly. It has happened from time to time. We have procedures in our processing center. It sounds like they probably filed using paper, maybe not. They probably didn't pay electronically. Of course, that would come through right away. But it does take some time to open the mail when it comes into the processing center. And bank those checks. But as soon as we know there's a check in that envelope, it is handled, very quickly. And the Secretary of State standards for deposit, I believe, are within 24 hours. So we get that banked and deposited. The machinery that processes those checks is incredibly fast. So we do our very best to get that in there. If this is a specific issue, I'm happy to try and see if it got lost in the mail or if there's some other reason for it. I'd be happy to connect with you offline to look into that constituent issue. But it is not the norm.
Okay, so with based on that, when you do, and I'm assuming that you're receiving a fair amount of paper that's coming through. A lot of people have not adapted to electronic filing. Some people still don't even have computers in this day and age and stuff. Some people prefer not to use computers and stuff. So if that is the case, then do you have adequate staff in order to get through these? Because if he is based on what he's saying is that he sent his returns in back in April, and if the feds at the same time, if they've found his check and cash, and I'm assuming that he processed both with the same way, perhaps it was by paper, but if the feds got it done and we didn't get it done here at the state, and he'd written the state two times to find out what happened, is there are you staff at a level that can handle this?
Mr. Cotter, in the processing center every year, we hire on seasonals to handle the increased workload with the processing of manual paper files. I know that they usually the processing center has the time frames from I think it's early March when we have the bulk of the tax to pay returns coming in, and those people stay on to open mail and process those payments until I believe mid-May to get through that crunch. Now, almost 90% of taxpayers file electronically now. So the workload has substantially declined since the mid-90s, and it's much less costly to process electronic payments and returns than it is paper. I believe it's somewhere around 10 to 12% between pen and ink, paper and pen, and 2D barcode, which are software prepared returns. 2D barcode prepared returns are much quicker to process. They're scanned and much more efficient. So I think there might be something else with this particular case. Maybe got lost in the mail. I don't know, but I'd be happy to look into it.
Okay. Senator Johnson.
No, please.
Senator Representative Gomber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon. Mr. Bouchard, I wanted to go back to the failure to file question. And earlier in the week, we saw this slide, you may remember, the operational metrics. And the upper chart here, as I understand it, reflects the number of people who have submitted federal returns but not state returns. And the difference here is it looks like about 100,000 people submitted federal returns and not a state return. And of those 100,000, we have contacted about 80,000 of those. In other words, 80%. I'd like to know what we need to do in your department to reach the other 20% of the people, those folks that have filed federal returns but not state returns. If you're reaching 80% of them, how do we raise that number up?
Okay. Chairman, Representative, I think that I would probably go back to the department in that specific work area and ask them to review their processes and answer that question. That happens in terms of the timeline and the workflow process. That happens well beyond the actions that are taken in my section. Is that fair to do for?
Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Gomberg, our filing enforcement processes happen prior, well before they get to Steve's section of the department for which he's responsible. What we do is people, we have enough information to know that they didn't probably need to file a return, so we don't, based on their Oregon income, based on federal TAPE information, sometimes we determine that they are owed a refund, and so we just let them file because they have 3 years to do that. So it could be that there's some differences in there, but I think what we can do is we can find out what that makeup is and follow up.
All right, so the short answer is I'm asking the wrong people right now.
Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Gomberg, I think Joanne Martin would have been the best person, or maybe Katie Lawley, who was here yesterday. So
all right,
we will follow up with you and get an answer for
you.
Well,
if I could just clarify my question, and I'll look forward to the answer to it. People that have filed their federal returns but not their state returns, we're reaching about 80% of them. My understanding is if we haven't contacted those people, even if we suspect they owe us money, we're not counting that in the $660 million that we say is currently due and delinquent. And so my second question would be, do we have any kind of estimate about what kind of dollars that 20% gap reflects? Did those questions make sense?
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Gomberg, yes.
And I'll look forward to if you could share that with our LFO staff, and we can share that with the entire committee.
Okay.
Senator?
Ms. Mack, disabuse me of the notion that there's a room someplace with a mountain of envelopes and a bunch of guys with paper slitters.
Well, Senator, Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Johnson, I would love to give you a tour of our building, but there is a processing center. We do have a machine that does slit envelopes open quite fast, and then there are people that actually open those and sort them and get them to the right places in our processing center or mailroom. It is not the kind of mailroom in which I first was hired 25 years ago. It's much scaled down due to e-file, but it's still there.
Okay.
Only unique and oversized or odd envelopes are handled by individuals.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, let me check out this. Okay, so the next slide is about our aging of our accounts receivables. And you can see that the 0 to 89 days, that it represents about 9% of what we have in our accounts receivable. Most of that early debt is self-assessed, so that's the voluntary compliance we talk about in that first, that darkest blue bar. The next category is the 90 to 179 days. That's 29% of the AR, and a big chunk of that is the estimated tax debt that we were just talking about. The next category is 180 days to 1 year. That is about 7%. So you can see as time goes on, the balances get lower and lower until we get to the more than 4 years, which is a large category of numbers, and it goes to 27%. But again, most of the debt in each category is made up of, the later debt is made up of estimated tax returns.
So these bar charts represent, again, the AR in the three categories I spoke of, which is personal income tax, corporation debt, and withholding. I thought it was important to illustrate, again, the recognition of the type of debt that is failure to file and estimated returns that the department has imposed on individuals. And so that category is the darkest color for Pitt, up to the $350 million value.
Okay, we have a question, Mr. Co-Chair.
Yeah, I'm looking at that chart. If I'm reading this correct, under corporate income, the estimated tax that we have, is that correct?
Mr. Co-Chair, yeah, that is correct, because we have they're generally in the corporate tax section, they are multinational, multi-state, they're operating across the country or in other countries as well, and so they file returns with us. We have a unit there that examines what we call nexus, and that's to determine whether they have a connection to the state that requires them to file a return. So they do nexus questionnaires and send them out to the companies, and they do a small amount of filing enforcement, but most of them are big companies. They're very easy to identify. And that's why most of the receipts related to that program have to do with audit, because the issue with audit is whether they fairly apportion their income to Oregon. And so it's an audit issue. It takes several years to complete those audits sometimes.
That is truly remarkable.
It goes back to, Mr. Co-Chair, the kind of the connection that John Hart was talking about yesterday, where there's more... it's more visible. There's a lot of these corporations have to file SEC reports and the 10-Ks, and there's a lot of information out there about those companies. So the more visibility, the more reported the income is, the more more effective we are at enforcing.
That's really remarkable. If you look at the individual, so from that, they're not. The bulk are individuals that's making up our economy here, and not these corporations that's been out there crying about they're paying too much, probably in other states, but certainly not here in Oregon.
Mr. Co-Chair, I believe in one of our in our phase one presentation, there's a slide that illustrates that I believe it's $15 billion of personal income tax paid to $1 billion in corporate tax paid to the state. It's in one of the first slides. It's just an outline of the state of Oregon and kind of a graphic there that illustrates exactly that.
Okay. I would like to get with the Revenue Committee to take a look at this because this is a potential grandmother that's retired is paying more money than a corporation here in Oregon.
Sure, they would like to hear from you. All right, so the next slides are about the collections process generally. What we do, first off, to create our accounts receivable is we have to send some sort of an assessment notice. When a person goes and voluntarily complies and files a return by the due date and they owe a little bit of money, that's what we call self-assess. That means I do this every year, I'll do this
so
every year.
Let me ask a quick question on that. When you send out an assessment notice, how much time do you normally allow for the citizen to reply back?
Mr. Co-Chair, an assessment notice, usually there's 30 days after to pay it in full before we start dealing with, we'll send a notice of demand for payment after that point. In our other agency accounts program, because the debt is older, we've had, it's been in another agency being collected on, we actually send that demand payment in 10 days, but we wait 30 days from the assessment notice for all of our assessment notices. In fact, a notice of deficiency that we send as a result of an audit, we usually have 30 days from that date before we send a notice of tax assessment as a result of the deficiency.
So just so I'm clear, so on a typical first notice, a first contact with an Oregonian for a first time, mm-hmm. there's typically a 30-day?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, there's the very first notice that a taxpayer has is the of a bill is that assessment notice. Unless it's an audit, they get advance notice in that case. But the assessment notice.
How much would that advance notice be?
30 days, Mr.
Okay.
Co-Chair.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So, and they have actually 30 days to pay that notice without incurring penalty for failure to pay. So, under the current law. So a notice of assessment, notice of self-assessment, notice of deficiency assessment, or a failure to file assessment, those are all notices of assessment that start the billing process for the department. From that point, we issue a notice in demand for payment. That's required by law. We cannot act to seize anyone's property until a notice of demand for payment has been issued because we are not allowed to issue a warrant, a distraint warrant, a collection warrant, until 30 days have passed since a demand for payment notice has been issued. So we're looking at least 60 days before we start getting to where we take collection actions. And most assessment notices have a 90-day appeal period. If it's not a self-assessed, like if there's a deficiency assessment or failure to file assessment. So those warrants aren't recorded until well after their appeal rights have expired. And recorded, I mean, in the county lien record. That's at the point once that warrant is issued on that very first slide I talked to you about liquidated debt. That's when this debt becomes liquidated and delinquent is at that point. So it was about 60 days before it becomes liquidated and delinquent debt before we move on. And then the next thing we do is the lien. We record in the county records if it is still not paid after 90 days from the first assessment notice. And we also issue a notice of intent to offset, and that's under federal law. We have an exchange agreement with the federal government so that our refunds will pay their tax debt and the federal refunds will pay our tax debt. But we have to wait at least 120 days from the time that the debt was first assessed before we can issue that notice.
Representative Gomberg has a question.
Thank you. I went back up to the lien process. Mm-hmm. So all of our liquidated accounts have liens filed on them.
Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Gomberg, they have at least a non-docketed lien, which would be not recorded in the county records, but definitely issued. And then some that go longer have it recorded in the county records.
And what are we paying counties to file those liens?
Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Gomberg, I would have to get a certain number on that, but I believe it's it varies between $16 to record to $32, depending on the county.
And off the top of your head, how many of these do we file annually?
I believe the last statistics I was given, Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Gomberg, was somewhere around 37,000 this last year.
And if I could continue,
of course,
Mr.
Please.
So we're only filing in the county of my residence, and this would be on my personal property. So if I have property in other counties, that would not be subject to the lien?
Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Gomberg, that is correct. We've had legislation in the past that have considered trying to centralize that idea, where we have one central place in the areas to do a centralized lien registry, for lack of a better term. And the funding mechanism goes to the counties, and it creates a great distress for them to not have that funding stream for the recording.
I understand. Sending out $300,000, $400,000 to the counties would affect them. On the other hand, sending out $300,000, $400,000 to those counties affects us.
correct.
Yet I've got a couple of questions about that. And the lien process, I think, is so critical, because if I don't pay my Nordstrom's bill, it affects my credit rating. But if I don't pay my taxes, it has no effect on my credit rating, because they only track consumer debt. The exception to that is that they do track liens. So once you file a lien on me, it shows up in my credit rating. And the next time I want to go buy a boat, the banks know that I haven't been paying my taxes. I guess my last question for you on this subject is, we heard from the Secretary of State's office earlier this year that they have a new automated liening process that they can implement electronically. And it seems to me that would be statewide rather than county by county. And it suggests to me that there's an opportunity to work through that process to file liens at a savings of roughly $300,000-$400,000 a year, plus access statewide assets rather than county by county.
Yeah, Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Gomberg, we also file it in the UCC record with the Secretary of State. We have authority under 305-182 to do that currently, and it's a $10, I believe, filing fee with them, and then we can renew it every 5 years, I believe.
And so how often do you do that?
We have stepped that up with our, Mr. Co-Chair, with our Gentax automation process. We used to do that pretty infrequently for businesses, because what happens in real life is a business will go out of business, and then they'll call us and they'll say, you're next in line, and they want us to come get their grills and their napkins and their forks, you know, if it's a restaurant. And that's not particularly effective. We don't have necessarily a good place to store that.
They're
kind
not
of
a
stuff.
Private. Let me share with you, colleagues. I probably review 300 plus UCC filings a year, probably 15 to 20 of them are on companies that are in bankruptcy, going through a bankruptcy, perhaps could be in bankruptcy. And I think Rep. Gomberg is asking the exact right question. I've never seen a Department of Revenue lien, and I've been doing this for 25 years.
Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Smith, or Mr. Senator Manning and
yeah,
Representative
cool.
Smith, up until Gentax, we really didn't do it very often because they weren't very effective for us.
Let's step back on this. Do you mind if I take a thread off of your tapestry here? So now that we have the ability to do it and we're going to do it, what's our plans to implement the UCC? Because as you were just alluding to, there's going to be a time where you'll get the phone call and say you're next in line. But you know what? And we can poo-poo that and say, well, we don't want to go collect the furniture, but there is value there that could be utilized in one way or another.
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Smith, what we're doing is one of the things I'm looking at is whether we can coordinate with State Surplus and DAS to have a place, depending on the type of item. We have taken vehicles. I believe one time we got an airplane. It's been a long, long time ago. And there's some value in that. It just depends on if it's free and clear, if we if there's equity in the item that we have, and if we have space to store it, and if we can have the capacity to hold an auction. So it's definitely something we're exploring to see if we can have cooperation with DAS and State Surplus in that area.
So I'm going to come to you. Sir. One of the things, John, that I think would be really beneficial as we're in a public hearing type process is to invite our lending community, the credit unions, the banks, credit extenders, to come in and visit with us and ask them, would it be beneficial to them, and what's their professional opinion? Would it help us as a state in collections if those efforts were significantly increased? Intuitively, I know the answer is yes. Because as a lender myself, I'm not going to extend credit to an entity when I know that the Department of Revenue has an outstanding issue, and by result will be first in time, first in line, and ahead of me. And yet that information is not out there right now. So, Senator Johnson.
Two things. One of them is, and forgive me for stepping out for a second, why the reluctance to publish the names of people that haven't filed? I know you have the list.
Mr. Co-Chair, for people who haven't filed returns?
Well, tax scofflaws.
Okay, so forgive, indulge me, Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Johnson. The tax scofflaws, like people who are just debtors, like we have posted people on our website as a pilot project for who are debtors, and we just finished that process, evaluated that.
Share with me the evaluation, though, because I've gotten the impression that that's a pushback, that you guys don't like to do that, you haven't liked to do it.
Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Johnson, we heard anecdotally from other states about our posting cyber shame, that's the colloquial term
for it.
On putting debtors on our website. Some states post every debtor. Some states post their top 500. Some states post a few. They've told us anecdotally that the threat of being posted will cause people to pay their debt. And so we decided to try it as a pilot project. I believe it ended. We adopted a rule in 2015. I believe we did this in 2016. Posted every the top, was it 50 of each
It
program.
Wasn't very many.
It was not very many. And the people, 600, I think we got a few hundred thousand dollars, but it wasn't clear that we got payment from the activity related to the posting them on the website. So we couldn't identify if they would have paid anyway or if they would if it was solely because of posting them on the internet. Some states say it's very, very effective. Other states say it's not very effective, depending on their belief system. And so we decided to try it out. We got governor's office approval. We had authority under statute to post with anyone who had a docketed recorded warrant or lien, that we could put it in a centralized place. And we did do that.
Okay, and your body language, the way you're talking to me, suggests we did it, it's done, we're never going to do it again. And I don't know why. There are other publications that haven't been a bit shy about publishing water hogs, and it immediately gets a response. Why not? The same way with filing the liens, the way the chair was talking about. It seems to me that you could put some fangs in this, in the shame arena, and you don't want to.
Well, Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Johnson, it's not that we don't want to. We actually are still continuing to explore other options, and maybe the way we did it didn't work right. Maybe it wasn't rolled out properly. We're looking at the possibility of maybe having all debtors rolled out there to show that their information's on the website, and they can just look, and it's there. That's something we're still exploring.
DSL posts people that have unclaimed property. I don't know why this is so difficult.
Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Johnson, generally it's been an uncomfortable place because for the most part the department is subject to strict confidentiality provisions. For it's a Class C felony if we inappropriately disclose. So if we get it wrong, there's a pretty significant consequence to us. So we want to make sure we're doing it right. And that's one of the reasons why we don't post non-filers, because it's a particular of a return. The statute says we can't share a particular of a return. It's a Class C felony if we do, unless they've authorized us to do it.
The good news is God made the legislature, and we get to change that stuff.
And that's just where I was going.
I mean, if we're serious about collecting some of this debt, we ought to use every tool in our toolbox and not worry about hurting somebody's feelings.
Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Johnson, that would be that would make us probably the most comfortable if we had clear statutory authority to do that in both cases.
I see a bill, Mr. Co-Chair. The other thought that I would have is before you take an airplane again, make sure you know what you're doing.
Right.
Not Senator DeBoer will attest to the fact that not all airplanes are created equal and not all airplanes are maintained equally.
Representative Gumberg.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate Senator Johnson's question. I'm a little confused by the answer for a couple of reasons. One of them is that I know that the issue of publicly listing debtors was part of the most recent Secretary of State audit. That was one of the suggestions they made. When I heard the governor's presentation on delinquent debt just 2 weeks ago, she indicated that she wanted to see us move forward with publishing these names. But when I go online at oregon.gov, I see 50 delinquent debtors' personal income tax, last updated on January 20th, 2017, just For purposes of the record, the first name on the list is Randall Jeffers, who owes us, all of us, $3,889,816.42. My point being, it seems to me this stuff is out there and being updated. The governor wants to do it, and the Secretary of State does it. It looks to me like we're doing it. I'm just confused by the answer.
Oh, Mr. Co-Chair, we did do it in 2016. We have posted it. We did it as part of a pilot project, though, because we don't have we have authority to share otherwise confidential information to the extent it's necessary for collection purposes. And our attorneys have advised us, because of the Class C felony component, that we need to make sure that the information that we're sharing is already in the public realm, which is through the docketed, the recorded lien process. So the pilot project we did ended the end of 2016, and we've got a report that we put together for that. And we're exploring ways to see if we did it differently, if we could do it differently, if maybe we went about it the wrong way, if it makes more sense just to do withholding debt, which is a trust fund, or personal income tax debt, which is something that a lot of people don't have control over. It's definitely an evaluation process, and I think that's what the governor's office proclamation is about, is to have us continue that evaluation and make sure we can do it right.
Yep. Senator Johnson.
How many people are on that docketed lien report?
Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Johnson, I think that we record about 37,000 liens a year. There's not an actual report.
So you did 50 out of 37,000, and you are allowed to disclose for the purpose of collections, and I'm still feeling an enormous amount of pushback. If it was okay to do 50, is it not okay to do 51 or 52 or 150?
Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Johnson, it is. It was a manual process last year. We had to make sure that everything was docketed and make sure that we had all public information posted. So it was a manual process, and that's why we limited it up front.
Okay, well, that's the first time I've heard that it's a manual process.
It was a manual process.
Okay, but it wouldn't be now.
Mr. Co-Chair, we're looking at ways to evaluate that, Senator Johnson, to see if we can do it in a more automated way, to put everyone out there, but we haven't taken those steps yet. We're working on that part.
Okay. I don't want to be argumentative again, but we're working on it. God, the house is on fire. Are we polling to see if we should call the fire department? We ought to use every tool in our toolbox. The governor has indicated she's okay. It doesn't have to be done by hand. We've got a universe of 37,000. Out of 50, we got several hundred thousand dollars. I guess maybe this is not a question for you, but it's a question for the director. Why the pushback?
So I want to create action out of this.
So do I.
I really think you're on to something. Can you report back to us on what you think? I would like a kind of an assessment of where we are today in collection abilities, tools, the tools you have, versus those tools that would be the most effective. And if you could report back to us, and it would be awesome if you could get it to us ahead of time, so that we have a chance to digest it.
Ahead of time, just to clarify, before Monday?
Or two before you present it to the committee.
Okay.
So we're not seeing it in committee for the first time, but a day or two ahead.
Mr. Chair, please. Ways and Means is able to amend bills and have some bills of our own generated. Would this be something that you two would be willing to take to the big co-chairs as an action item out of this committee's work this session?
Senator Johnson, that's what I think we're thinking about. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. So as we move forward, I want to go back to one more issue, if we can go back on the assessment notice. What would you say if you had a constituent who received a letter and it gave 12 days to address the issue? The time the date was dated to the time when you're required to respond.
Mr. Co-Chair, I believe that sounds like it was probably an introductory audit letter where we asked people to connect with us within the first 2 days or first 12 days, a couple of weeks, to schedule and open an audit and try and get connected that way.
No, but then my question. My question is, is that ample time? What would you think about that?
Mr. Co-Chair, right now in the legislature, I would call immediately and I would say, please can I have an extension of time? Because we're all so busy right now.
What if someone's on vacation?
I agree.
If someone's on vacation and they come home and realize, gosh, that 2-week cruise I took happened to be when a letter arrived?
Mr. Cotter, I will find out what kind of notice time frames we have. I think that 2 weeks is probably a standard time frame to respond for those kinds of letters, but I can talk to Katie and the folks that are in our audit function.
I'm just curious.
Could be a processing center notice too, where we're trying to get the returns processed quickly.
Could you see where a constituent would be concerned if they take great pride in managing their credit, managing their affairs, they go out of town for 2 weeks, come back and realize they're now late? I'm just curious.
Yeah, we'll follow up. Okay, so back to the collections process. This slide actually illustrates the number, just kind of the timing and how, what things happen once a debt becomes established. The normal billing period I've already talked about is about a 90-day period, so that's the orange slides there. That's where taxpayer gets a billing notice. They either pay the tax or they enter into a payment plan with us, or they're exercising their appeal rights, so generally in that first little window. Then after that, we start into active collections, and that's generally when we start sending those legal collection notices like the distraint warrant, the notice to demand to pay. This is where we're trying to get connected with the taxpayer, where we're trying to locate assets, trying to get them to pay in full or set up a payment plan. This is also where we start garnishing people if there's an asset to garnish. It's also where, if it's depending on the size of the debt or the situation of the taxpayer, we may come out and visit the taxpayer and try and get a payment plan from them or payment in full. And then sometimes if we cannot do anything else, if we can't collect from them in any other way, then we end up with our advanced collections tools, including we can suspend occupational licenses and we can start seizing assets. And those are all appealable functions. Now, when we get out to that 1-year mark, if we haven't been able to collect the person in full, the law requires that we send that account to a private collection firm. We do that now.
Yes,
Mr. Johnson. Chair, can I go back? When you start grabbing professional licenses, that's a big deal. Mm-hmm. What's the track record on that look like?
I have that in one of my later slides, some information about how we actually do that, and there's some data behind that in one of my future slides, if I could cover that then.
Sure.
All right. Okay. So the private collection firms, we send the account to a private collection firm if they're out 12-plus months. The debtor, we will do it earlier if we know the debtor is out of state. There's nothing in the law that says that we can't send an account to a private collection firm earlier than 12 months, but we must once we get to the 12-month mark. So if the account is already if they have a year, let's say their 2013 tax debt is at a private collection firm, and now this year they have a new debt, we'll just send it out to the private collection firm so there's not two places collecting on them at once.
So I have a question, but I'm going to go with Senator Johnson then.
Of the 50 that you, I love the word cyber shame, that's my new word for today. I'm curious what of your methodologies you have employed. Somebody that owes us $3 million is a pretty, I'm guessing, high income, sophisticated taxpayer. Scofflaw, thank you. And I'm interested what all has been used on Jeffrey's account to motivate settling that obligation with the citizens of the state of Oregon.
Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Johnson, I'm not familiar personally with that specific account, but I can tell you by the time they got to that balance, and that's part of why it was such a manual review process, is that we wanted to make sure every collection tool we had in the toolbox had been used, such as if there was an occupational license that we had suspended it, if there was assets that we had seized them. A lot of those people that are in that category have shielded their assets from us. And it's been very difficult we've even considered criminal prosecution on some of them. The trouble with that is that there's no actual criminal statute that makes tax evasion a crime, so we have to look to, we can't prosecute them.
It's that kind of stuff. I've sat in this room I don't know how many years and begged agency heads and their managers that are on the front lines of this, tell us what would improve your business processes. What would make you more effective or more accountable? You've just told us that having a criminal statute for tax evasion, that to me seems like a no-brainer. And why somebody didn't tell us that 12 directors ago. Why none of us spelunked into it to figure it out? Shame on us. But, Mr. Co-Chairs, I feel a second piece of legislation
We're
moving.
Taking notes quickly here.
Apparently I'm an idea person. But, Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Johnson, really we just discovered that when we Attorney General Kroger was in place. I don't think we really realized that
that was 5 years ago. Where you been?
We've been trying to prosecute them. So this is something that we're developing and learning about the process. If there's some sort of a rolling window in there. So we'll work on
Ms. Mack. You're developing again. I want to see an action plan. I want you beating down the doors of the legislature saying this will make us more effective.
Okay.
Pass a bill for us.
Here's eight right here.
All right.
I just want to ask the question. Have you guys introduced legislation?
Mr. Co-Chair, we have not on that subject yet.
Okay. Let me ask one question, then I'm going to go to Rep. Gomberg. What tools do collection agencies have that we don't have? Why at 12 months are we turning these over? What ability do they have that we don't?
Mr. Co-Chair, we actually, I believe, have more tools than a private collection firm.
Did the legislature say we want you to turn it over?
Yeah.
What was the thought process there? Help us understand.
It was prior to my time in collections. I believe it was passed in 1999. And the requirement, I think that they came in and I think there was just a push for private collection firms to have the opportunity to collect the debt that we have to help with the background there.
Okay.
So
Usually there's a reason behind everything. I didn't know what it was.
Yeah,
okay.
It was back then.
Rep. Gomberg.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And I agree. I mean, all the indications are is that the department has tools that private agencies don't have, and the studies indicate that they do a better job of collecting than the private agencies do, as much as 300% better, perhaps because of those tools, because of other reasons. My question is, again, regarding these private collection firms, what kind of commissions are we paying these folks when we turn debt over to them?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Gomberg, I have that information in one of my later slides, if I may. Okay, thank you.
Okay, so really quick, I'm going to ask the committee to hold tight for 20 minutes. 20 minutes.
Thank you.
In 20 minutes, I'm turning them loose again, okay?
Thank you.
So write your questions down.
Okay, so moving on to the next slide then. These are some of the statutory tools that you have given us to do to collect these debts. Taxpayers have a right to enter into an installment plan. Obviously, sometimes they just come into a situation, maybe they become disabled or they are unemployed for a period of time. They need to just set up installment payments for whatever reason. Generally, if it's up to 12 months, we say, go ahead, pay it off. We just want to get you paid up so that next year you don't add to it. So that's why we give an automatic payment plan on our personal income tax program. Our business tax programs, we do payment plans up to 6 months because there's a quarterly filing requirement. So we don't want them to continue to accrue debt. So we want those payment plans to be shorter. The taxpayers can set these up online. If they can't afford to pay it within the standard guidelines, the 6 months or the 12 months, then we ask for additional information from them to show their ability to pay and what their discretionary income is. Extended payment plans can be approved with a lead worker review if it's between 12 and 18 months, and with manager approval if it's more than 18 months. We obviously want to try and get them paid as quickly as possible and not end up with additional debt owed to them. We also have authority to some discretion actually to create what we consider to be creative payment plans for situations where maybe they are seasonally employed or they have maybe a pending property sale and we can see that it's out there ready to go and they'll be able to pay in full. So we want to not have our hands tied on the flexibility that we have with establishing payment plans because no two taxpayer situations are the same. So we try and recognize that as we go through this process. I forgot the slides are all on one now. If they don't enter into a payment plan, we get into what we call active collections. And this is where we issue a notice of garnishment. Private collection firms can issue garnishments as well, but they have to go through a judicial process to do that. It's called a writ of garnishment. We can do them administratively, and we can send either one to an employer, which we call a wage garnishment, or a bank garnishment to a financial institution. The wage garnishment, we have technically our garnishments act to garnish 100% of the taxpayers' assets, but there is a wage exemption of 75%, so we send just a 25% garnishment right out of the gates, knowing that everyone's going to qualify for that 75% wage exemption. The Treasury Offset Program is the federal program that we use for the federal income tax refunds, where we get their federal income tax refund, or the taxpayer, we send their state refund to pay their federal debt. So we have an agreement with the federal government. We also just implemented in 2015 the state reciprocal program, SRP, which is federal vendor offset. So that's where we can take non-tax debt payments. So a vendor payment that is owed to the federal government will come to Oregon. We aren't a big winner as far as states go because we don't have a big federal presence here, but we do send quite a few taxpayer refunds to pay federal debt under that program. We are working right now as part of a state wide vendor offset project as a result of some conversations with Senator Johnson last year. We met with our sister agencies, ODOT and DAS, to try and figure out a way that we could actually interface with each other and seize each other's refunds. That was one of those things that we were working on as part of the Secretary of State report as well. So we're just about ready to roll out what we think we can do with that here in the next few months. And then also, of course, active collections includes referring accounts to private collection firms. So in those statistics that Representative Gomberg wanted to hear about is a private collection firm. I think right now the rate, maybe it's on a later slide. The average, the PCF collection rates, right now they have about $241 million assigned to them to collect, and they currently collect an average of about $325,000 a month, which is about a 0.14% collection rate, to answer your question earlier. So the different entities, we have three entities, ACT, PCS, and P&A, that we contract with right now, that they have different balances, so that $241 million is attributed to all three of them. In different breakdowns. They also charge us, they do charge the debtor, the cost to collect can be passed on to the debtor. So ACT has three tiers. They charge 17.9% all the way up to 26% if they have to do legal action. PCS is at 23% of the debt, and P&A is at 20% of the debt. So they have a fiduciary responsibility to collect as much as they can because they're a corporation and they charge those fees for their entities. So advanced collections, advanced collections include in-person visits. Sometimes we go out because we try and visually identify assets. Maybe there's a boat, maybe there's an RV or something that is some sort of asset they could either take a loan against, or we could seize if that's the case. Sometimes we've had to engage the sheriff to do till taps. We've gone out to businesses that are cash intensive and taken the cash in their till that night, at the end of the night, so that, to pay their tax debt. Oftentimes it's businesses, it's withholding tax debt, which isn't actually debt that's their own debt. It's they withheld their employees' pay, their employees' tax, personal income tax, and used it to float their business, didn't remit it to us. So we have a kind of higher standard since that is a trust fund there, so we'll do till taps on those businesses sometimes. We'll seize and sell. We've done safe deposit box drills. We've drilled those to see if there's assets in there. And we've actually done some stock sales if necessary for non-retirement accounts. We can't get at retirement accounts. Those are protected assets. And then again, there's license suspension. So the license suspension, we use that tool very judiciously because we kind of view it as, you know, if we seize their occupational license, then we're kind of cutting off our nose to spite our face, because then they lose their income source. So we take it very judiciously. Last year, and last biennium actually, we sent 46 notices of intent to suspend, which resulted in a couple $100,000 of payments, and we actually had to spend had to suspend 24 over the last biennium, and that resulted also in another couple $100,000. So we do really try to be judicious in that, recognizing we'd rather get them into a payment plan, and often that's what those result in, is payment plans. So from the payment plans, we have about $700,000 that is being paid from that we expect to be paid from those. other tools that you have. These are more for protecting debtors than they are tools to protect them from us being too aggressive. If a person for example, if they lose their job and they need to come back to us in 6 months to make their payments because they're temporarily unemployed, we'll put them into a status called temporarily uncollectible. And that is for a customer who currently does not qualify for like write-off or cancellation or settlement, but their situation is temporary in nature, like unemployed, like hospitalized, and they have a future ability to pay. They haven't become permanently disabled or something like that. So we will work with them and put them kind of in hold status to try and allow them time to get a job, to come back to us with a payment plan, but then we follow up with them in 3 to 6 months to get them back on track. Suspended collections is something that was, as of March 2017, in the temporarily uncollectible status, we have 451 taxpayers in that status right now. So the suspended collections is a bill you passed in the 2015 session that was very similar to the temporarily uncollectible status that we had, but we tried to acknowledge that they were different because there's actually some income tests in order to be put into suspended collections, and there's no requirement that they have a future ability to pay. So they can actually sit in this suspended collections status year by year if they have not very many assets until it goes into write-off status, which is usually 3 years before it'll go into the write-off status. Currently, this again was just passed in 2015. Most of these people that fit this criteria actually, when they apply for it, actually are eligible for cancellation because the debt is wholly uncollectible. They have no means or ability to pay. So we've had 503 applications for that and 353 of them either had wages, so they weren't qualified, or they were in a temporary situation, so they need to go into the temporarily uncollectible. But the people who qualified for this, most of them were canceled. The people who did actually qualify for this, most of those folks were canceled. So in cancellation and write-off, I think that there was 150 of people that did qualify, and 108 of them we did cancel. Excuse me. So settlement offer is our last tool. That's something that we have by statute and then adopted in our administrative rules. This is a case where a taxpayer comes to us and says, look, I know I owe this. I want to pay it. I don't have the means to pay it. We take a financial statement. We ask for a down payment, a good faith down payment of the amount that they think that they can settle for. And then we have an evaluation process. Prior to Gentax rollout, that was a manual process, and it would take sometimes up to 6 months to get an approval process. With Gentax, the application process is online, and we can do everything, including talking to taxpayers, getting additional information in less than 90 days now. So it's cut our processing time on these settlement offers in half. Person has to have basically no assets to borrow against. They have to complete agreed upon terms, and that is future compliance. So if we agree to cancel their debt, then we say, okay, but you have to be in compliance for the next 3 years or this is going to be reinstated. And so they agree to all of that. So write-off and cancellation, there were some comments about this earlier in the week in the presentation. Write-off happens, it's a function of statute. We've had it in place, I believe we put it in place in 2006, and our first account started being written off in 2007. The criteria is established by the agency, and at the time we did it, it was approved by both the Attorney General and the Secretary of State's office for our write-off criteria. Since then, the legislature has eliminated the Secretary of State from that approval process, and it's just by the AG. But for our debts, if there's been no assets located, no correspondence, no payments in the last 3 years, the debtor is still alive. We can tell that they're at least still alive somewhere, and the debt isn't older than 7 years, then we'll take it off our books and put it kind of in a holding queue, what we call write-off. It's not permanently extinguished. If they resurface, if they come back to Oregon perhaps and start another job, or we get some sort of an indicator that they're here and that we have a collection source, we'll reinstate it and start collections on that. It does stay in the AR. It doesn't ever come out until it's actually canceled, but it is in a different category. For last year, we wrote off in personal income tax about $195,000 of debt, representing 159 taxpayers, and 33 of those were reinstated last year. So for cancellation, though, that debt is different. That debt is, if we determine that it needs to go away, then it's forever extinguished. It cannot be reinstated if we later find them, if they resurface, if they have assets somehow. But they have to meet, obviously, the criteria of write-off first. So no correspondence, no assets located in the prior 3 years, no payments in 7 years. We also have criteria where they have had to have been out in the field office for more than a year. And if they are deceased, they have to not have an open estate. So we will file claims in the estate if necessary, if there's a probate or if there's assets out there. We do also cancel debt if the debt is wholly uncollectible, when the taxpayer is insolvent. That if the cost to collect is greater than what we could ever hope to recover, then we have authority under the statute to cancel debt in that situation too. So it may be not as old as 7 years, but it could be no ability for them to pay. So you have any other questions about that before I move to other agency accounts?
We're still muzzled.
Nope. she opened the door. All right. So
that was only 12 minutes.
We made it 12 minutes.
Senator Johnson, do you have questions?
I do. I have one. Reflecting back on your comments about the professional licenses, one that's always been a bit of a quandary for me is grabbing somebody's commercial driver's license. If their source of income is their ability to drive a truck, and we choke off the only avenue by which they can garner any kind of assets to satisfy your situation. Mm-hmm. How often does that happen?
Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Johnson, of the occupational licenses we suspend, we actually, about half of them have to do with CDLs. In fact, there's a bill going through the legislature right now that would actually remove that authority from us, Senate Bill 693. It's in Ways and Means. So we would no longer be able to suspend a CDL if that was the case. It's a last-ditch effort. We've tried everything. People have shielded their assets. We have tried to garnish. We've entered into payment plans, usually more than once, to try and get that money out of them. And it's truly something that we don't like to have to do because of the exact reason. It's the way that they would hopefully pay us. So we would much rather have them enter into a payment plan, show us that their financial condition, show us that they have the ability to pay. And sometimes taxpayers don't like to provide their bank statements. They don't like to show where their money is going. And so they don't do that. And that's sometimes how they get to that point. But usually we get them to enter into payment plans, and that's where the bulk of that money comes from.
Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. When you say garnish, if somebody's actually working, isn't it fairly easy for you to garnish salaries?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator DeBoer, it is very easy if they are not self-employed. It's very difficult if we send a wage garnishment to a business where that person is responding to the garnishment. They tend to not respond to that. So if they are self-employed by someone else, then it's very, very easy to issue a garnishment.
And one other thing, it's not dischargeable in bankruptcy, I believe, taxes.
Mr. Co-Chair and Senator DeBoer, it can be if it's old enough, but it's not very common that it gets to that point.
Mr. Co-Chair,
I have a couple of comments, probably not questions. One is that listening to everything, all heads are nodding in terms of what we need to do in order to put some teeth in this, empowering or doing some legislations to have criminal acts for those that don't pay fines. I know they do that at the federal level. The other part is that I'm amazed that we have the ability to collect fines or collect on debt, and yet we get to a point where we outsource it. So the taxpayer is paying twice for a service that we already have the capability and capacity and resources to do. I like to draw that rein it back in, and because that is a state function, and I think that the way the Department of Revenue Oregon State is running right now, they've got too many people taking pieces out of the pie, which is contributing to a loss of a lot of revenue. And I want to talk about first reversing whatever that decision was to outsource this, because we're paying someone else to collect, and then they're giving us back a portion of what they collect, and they're getting fat off of it. The other part is that people that are tax evaders, and that's what we're talking about now, there are punishments for tax evaders at the federal level. I think we need to look at the federal level and consider using a model similar to that at the state level. So I just want to put that out there. These are my thoughts moving forward.
Perfect. I'm just going to keep going around the dice. Can you turn to slide number 9? Is that 9? Oh.
Number 9?
I'm looking at the AR aging, the pie chart. We all come into this building with different life experiences. This aging tells us some data, but what it's not telling us is the quality or dysfunction in this accounts receivable. I think it'd be very powerful, especially knowing the direction the governor is asking us to go, for the Department of Revenue, for you folks, to tell us the likelihood of collections on each of these slices of the pie. Mm-hmm. I know when I go before my loan committees and have to report and give them the aging, they ask what's the likelihood of repayment. And I think it would be eye-opening for those who do not serve in Ways and Means to find out that many of these debts, you're just not going to collect on them. You know, someone who's sitting in prison for 35 years and owes us $1 million, chances are we're not collecting on that. And so I think we need to know the quality of these agents.
Okay.
And if I need to... Is that pretty clear what I'm asking for?
Mr. Co-Chair,
what's the likelihood
it is, actually,
of collecting each slice?
Right, it is actually, because like Steve talked about and John Hart talked about yesterday, the estimated debt is not necessarily, it's not dollar for dollar collectible, because a person could file a return based on their true situation, that they have itemized deductions and they have 6 kids and they're married, and we don't know that for a fact. So our assessment may be too high. They come in and file a return and we find out that they had... payments, or somehow they might even be owed a refund. So,
right.
So that those estimated returns that we talk about are have a very different type of collectability than someone who self-assesses. Self-assessed debt is very collectible because they did it, they said, "Hey, I owe you money and I want to pay you." So, the earlier that we get to that, the debt, the quicker it is to collect. But that filing enforcement debt is a different beast. So we're happy to provide some of that information. We have that.
And let me think through this just a little bit further. So in my view, we've got the pie chart. We have the aging. If you folks will put together the quality of the receivable. And then what I would like on that is, what tools, based upon each slice of the pie, do you need to enhance the probability of collection based upon the quality of each slice of pie? Does that make sense? So, on the 0 to 89, chances are it's not going to take much of a hammer. On the more than 4 years, chances are it's going to be very uncollectible, I'm assuming. I don't know. I'm making
some
this
of the
up.
Debt that's in that category, for example, is Mr. Co-Chair, is senior deferral. It's just the senior deferral program has a lien against the property and it sits for quite some
time. That's what we need to know.
Yes. So
right there.
It isn't even collectible yet until that person passes away.
Right.
So we can get that for you.
Perfect. Okay. Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I got two questions. One of them's on page 12, and we were talking there about vendors. And you characterize this in terms of a pilot project and seizing refunds from other agencies, which makes sense, grabbing hold of some of the money that we're already paying out. But the vendor question is a little broader than that. The last Secretary of State audit indicated that there are 9,000 businesses in Oregon that we are hiring to do work for us that owe money to us. Now, I got to tell you, my entire sojourn through this delinquent debt question, nothing makes me crazier than the fact that people that owe us money are getting paid by us in a different department. I think, Mr. Chair, at one point I described it as making me absolutely barking crazy, that we are paying people that owe us money. And I understand some of the challenges there when we've got computer systems that don't talk to each other, and we've got agencies that don't communicate as effectively as they do. But I need, again, we keep saying, some kind of plan on how we begin to address this question of people that we hired to do work for us that owe us money, not just the Department of Revenue, but maybe the ODOT is hiring them for a striping project and they owe the Construction Contractors Board some money. And I would be happy if we could simply start by putting in the contract of every state vending program a line that says, we don't owe anybody any money.
Mr. Co-Chair and Senator or Representative Gomberg, currently the current contract law requires them to self-certify that they are in tax compliance, and there's no authority for us to verify that. You tried to pass, I believe it was 4122 a couple of years ago about related to IT projects after Cover Oregon happened, and there was some language that we inserted in there that couldn't get through that would allow us to verify if they actually were in compliance before you issued that contract. So that is something we're happy to engage with you on and work with folks on. I believe the Gentax system has a capacity for people to come to us and print out self-certification that they're in compliance. Mm-hmm. We have to turn that on if there's a law that would be passed that required that. But that's a feature that we have in our new system that could be used. And they could attach it to their contract.
Mr. Chairman, that sounds like Bill number 3. You know, as somebody who's cheating the state of Oregon is being asked to self-certify that they're not cheating us. Okay. Let me wrap my head around that, and then I'll move on to question number 2, which has to do with settlements. Mm-hmm. You talked about the process there, and you talked about the statutes that outline the criteria by which we settle. I got to say, the whole area of settlement sounds to me like somebody responded to a late night television ad saying, call our law firm if the government's after you for taxes, and we'll help you cut that debt in half. I'm looking at your accounts for this past year, and I see while the write-offs were about $15 million, that the adjustments were $150 million. And I understand that there are statutory criteria by which you make those adjustments and make those write-offs. My question is, who reviews those decisions and who writes at the bottom of the form that I certify that these write-offs, these adjustments, these cancellations were done according to the statutes, and I take responsibility for that decision?
So, Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Gomberg, in all of the processes where we have the ability to cancel debt, we have internal controls set in place. So there's generally an agent, a collector, who does an evaluation, says, I think this person does qualify for this. And then they set it up in the system for someone to review. And depending on the size of the account, there can be up to 3 levels of review. I think one of them might end with Steve here for cancellation, so that we can make sure that there's no collusion, that this is actually being properly done, and those internal controls are in place for that. And it's for, I believe, all of those cancellation type actions, including settlement.
Well, that sounds encouraging. I just don't want to send the message that if you stall long enough, that we'll cut a deal with you.
Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Gomberg, that we definitely don't encourage that.
Representative, okay. We're good? All right, please continue.
Let's see, go back to where I was.
So really quick, okay. Committee, I have to scoot. I have a commitment at the governor's office, so I'll turn it over to Mr. Co-Chair, and Thank you for all you've done today.
All right, so our other agency accounts program, this is created by this legislature in 1971, created the centralized collections unit in the Department of Revenue, and it's in ORS 293.250. That's where our authority is found. We collect delinquent debt for about 180 what we call client agencies, because they are our clients, including agency boards, commissions, the circuit and district courts, universities, and a wide variety of regulatory agencies. The ORS 293.231 is the statute that requires a debt currently to be, state agencies have to choose whether to assign a debt to a private collection firm or to our other agency accounts process. And that has to happen within 90 days of there being no payment on the account. So that doesn't necessarily mean that the account is only 90 days old. They may have been getting payments from them. But once the payments stop, they have to get it to us within 90 days of that that last payment, or a private collection firm. They have that choice under current law. Our other agency accounts program has two services that we offer. It is, we call it full collections, where we can actually issue garnishments, that kind of thing, or we have what we call refund offset only. And other agencies that have full stepped up collections functions, like the Department of Employment, ODOT, or DHS for their overpayment recovery programs, a lot of those accounts just come to us for offset only because they're already doing enforced stepped up collections. Our other agency accounts program for the fiscal year 2016 collected $61 million. Averaging that out, it works out to about $5 million a year. Of course, that's cyclical. Some months it's much higher because of the personal income tax refund process, and then other months it's lower. But the average is $5 million. And the administration of the program is funded by collection fees. So it's an other fund program, and our client agencies pay us to perform the services. And the fees that we charge range from 10% to 18% historically, but I think right now most of them pay about 15% of our cost. It is not a profit for profit. So if we end up having more, if 15% for example this year is too much, then we will rebate that back to our client agencies, the excess over what our actual costs were. So that is a self-funded program. And that was also part of rollout three, in fall of 2016, our other agency accounts was put into place. So you can see, debts. This other agency accounts program actually has implemented risk scoring. They've got debt scoring, so they can actually put things out, you know, and identify and triage the debts a little bit differently depending on the type of collector that we have to assign it to. And we look at things like whether they have another, if they're a vendor, perhaps the state, or if they're not receiving public assistance. We can't collect from someone who only has a source of income that's public assistance, so we try and triage it that way. That's something we're still working on for the personal income tax program. It's much, much larger than this. So the type of debt that we have, that we're able to collect from, this is just a sample, and you can see the recovery rate over a five-year period is substantially, it varies substantially depending on the economy, depending on the type of debt that's assigned. PERS debt, you'll see, was very collectible. That was because the Strunk decision, where we could remit it net. So that a lot of that was very, very collectible debt. But you can see the range depends on higher education. Presumably people have got jobs that are professional level jobs, so they have a garnishment or a source of income to collect to pay from. Oregon Health and Science University, OHSU, we collect for that program both medical and educational debt. We don't know what type of debt it is, but it is for both of those types. In 2015, you folks passed Senate Bill 55, which modified the ORS 293.231 that allowed Department of Revenue to pass on our costs of collection to the debtor for other agency accounts. So we were put on equal footing with private collection firms in that case. It used to be that the private collection firm could pass the cost of their fee we could pass the cost of a private collection firm onto a debtor, but we could not pass the cost of other agency accounts onto a debtor. And what that did was it caused state agencies to choose to use a private collection firm over the Department of Revenue, because the Department of Revenue couldn't be reimbursed for their costs from the debtor. Now we're on equal footing out of Senate Bill 55 from last year.
What, could you rerun that again, please?
Mm-hmm. So under prior law, prior to 2015, an agency that's had a collectible that they sent to a private collection firm could also collect from the debtor the cost of using that private collection firm. Now, if they had chosen to send the debt to the Department of Revenue to collect in other agency accounts, then they had to bear that cost themselves as an agency. They could not pass that on to the debtor. Senate Bill 55 has equalized that. So now it doesn't matter whether the agency chooses other agency accounts to use as a collection agency or if they use a private collection firm to use as a collection agency. In both cases, the cost of collecting that debt can be passed to the debtor. So hopefully it took away that incentive to choose one way or the other. So OAA, other agency accounts, is required. So by the time we get the debt, it's already been well established under the other our client agency's procedures. So they don't challenge, debtors cannot come to us and challenge the validity of the debt. It's already been done at that client agency. Like in the tax world, they can appeal to the Department of Revenue. We can, you know, dispute the tax, and then it becomes final in the court system. And then we do our collections for, so we're the agency that does that work too. But when we get to our other agency accounts program, our client agencies are the ones that do that work. So if there's an outstanding child support debt or an outstanding OHSU debt or wherever it's coming from, that due process has happened at that agency. So when agencies come here, when they send the debt to us, we have 1 year to collect. The statute actually says 6 months, but DAS has granted us an exemption because it makes sense that we have a year to do that because of the refund offset process. So the statute currently says 6 months to send a refund, to send an account back to our client agency, but DAS has authority to and has granted an exception to that. And they have given us 1 year so that we can account for that cycle. One of the other programs, the processes that we have in our other agency accounts program is the license reinstatement program, and that is very, very effective tool in collecting judicial debt. I know the courts have the ability to suspend driver's licenses, not just occupational licenses, but driver's licenses in many, many, many situations. And we have been able to enter into a payment plan process with debtors who have their license suspended by the courts, and we will reinstate it provisionally as long as they have a payment plan with us. Last year, I think we collected about $1.5 million from that program for judicial debt, which is very, very difficult to collect that type of debt. Senate Bill 693 that is in this body now does take away some of those reasons for courts to be able to suspend licenses. So we will have fewer licenses to reinstate, but we still do have that tool. So just for your awareness. The other agency accounts also allows taxpayers to enter into payment plans, and obviously we like them to do as much self-service as possible. So with Gentax, we have self-curing options. They can set up a payment online. It also sends, if a payment plan breaks, which a large number of them do break, just across the agency, not just in other agency accounts, but they'll send a notification to a collector that the payment plan is broken. We make sure that staff know when that's happening so we can get right on it and get right back in to find out if, you know, did they have a, I mean, this has happened to me personally. My debit card was compromised, and so my automatic payments stopped for 1 month, and I thought, I need to wait till I get my new card. So it gives people a chance to figure that out or figure out if they actually do have an inability to pay. Okay. So do you want to talk about this, or do you want me to?
So going forward, for the personal income tax, corporation tax, withholding tax collections process, we have thoroughly gone through the transformation in that section with our new Gentax system. So we are reviewing processes, becoming as proficient as possible in all of our processes and steps. Our intent to maintain full capacity and staffing, we're looking towards that in the future. We right now have a large disposition with vacancies, as you know and as you've heard, and that affects the collection area just as well. We have 22 vacant positions in the personal income tax collection section, 8 vacant positions in the business withholding collection section, and 4 vacant positions in other agency accounts.
Okay. Okay, there was how many in the corporate vacancy?
Well, actually, the corporate section is part of the business collection section, okay. So there's eight in that section.
Eight? Okay, that, okay.
I was going to share that Representative Smith talked about taking the debt in the terms of the pie chart of the age of the debt and talk about the collectability or the challenging pieces of those debt. By and large, 42% of the debt that we collect on is estimated returns. And so I don't know that there is a lot of ways to slice that up and determine collectability. I like to look at it and understand it as self-assessed debt. We have a pretty high rate of return from anywhere from 15 to 18% at times collecting on self-assessed debt. Filing enforcement and estimated return debt that makes its way into the accounts receivable is very difficult to collect. In fact, some states in the nation view that debt as a return provoking tool, and they don't even apply that debt towards the accounts receivable. And so I wanted to throw that out there as a thought or a concern that we have in terms of putting that debt in our responsibility, because it makes up for such a large part. One of the openings charts that we showed had the taxes, penalty, and interest within the accounts receivable, and debt that has been placed there by virtue of estimated return has a 100% penalty associated with it. So the taxes is times two on that, so that's how severe it impacts the accounts receivable. We are continuing to focus on staff training and development of our new system. We haven't mastered every part of it. Although the collections section is large, we have 165 positions associated with collections, and there are a lot of elements to collections. We have RA Revenue Agent 1 positions, 2 positions, and 3 positions, and they vary in skill set and level. But the section, by virtue of their efforts, brings in just under $16 million every 28 days. Most of that is a result of manning the automated call distributor, as well as working within the Gentax system. And so we are continually looking at our processes, from the manner in which we field phone calls to the processes that are available within Gentax. Over time, we look towards the data that's captured with collection values that enter the system, and how we can look at scoring the debt, and how we can look at manners in which we approach that debt differently than we do today.
Okay, so before you continue on, I think that we're going to have more of collections next week. So why don't we do this, unless there are questions from the committee at this time.
Mr. Kocher, I only have 2 pages left.
You got 2
pages. I could catch us up.
Okay, well, let's go with your 2 pages then.
If you have the if it's your pleasure.
No, let's go with the 2 pages.
Okay. So, Mr. Co-Chair, thank you for your grace. You always ask us, how can we help you? And so one of the things that we do every biennium is we bring forward concepts. We obviously haven't brought all of them forward. We can only bring so many. This session we brought forward 3 related to collections. We actually brought forward 22 concepts. I believe there were 6 of them in property tax, 9 in corporate tax, and then 3 collections, and the rest were in personal income tax programs. So we have quite a large number of them. But the 3 that are collection related, actually Senator Taylor and Senator Johnson have been instrumental in getting those through. Senate Bill 254 and our mirror bill, our concept 2272, is the Financial Institution Data Match Bill. That requires financial institutions to enter into agreements with us to share debtor information and match accounts. Right now, our garnishment process, we kind of have to guess where a person banks. Financial Institution Data Match will allow us to know where they bank, and we can just issue a garnishment to that place. Employment new hire reporting. Under federal law, anytime you hire someone or rehire someone, you have to report within 20 days to that agency, to the child support agency, that they have become employed here. Our payroll tax returns come in on a quarterly basis, and so we don't get that information for 4 to 6 months about someone who's been newly hired. So those that bill, Senate Bill 254, would accelerate our access to that information, and both of those tools would make us better at our garnishment process, either through bank garnishments, financial institution garnishments, or at wage garnishments. Lottery withholding bill is Senate Bill 251. The governor has already signed that one. That one will become effective in September, and that changes the threshold of withholding on lottery prizes. Currently, the payment, any prize payment over $5,000 has an 8% withholding rate. It drops it down to $1,500. There's pretty substantial noncompliance with people reporting their prize payments. So this moves up the collectability of that debt rather than waiting for us to audit it a year and a half or 2 years when we get the information on tape information from the feds. So we would encourage
Just for the point of clarity, it's taken at the point where they collect their winnings.
Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Johnson, that's correct, at the lottery office, and that's why that threshold of $1,500 was chosen, because everyone who has a prize payment of $1,500 or more is subject to that. So it's very streamlined. They already have the process in place. It's just changing a table, basically, from $5,000 to $1,500.
Just real quick question. Now, up there, you have HB 254, and you got SB 254 twice, but you have a House Bill 2272, and the other one's 2271. Does Senate Bill 254 address both of those?
Mr. Co-Chair, that is correct. The bill that Senator Johnson has and Senator Taylor does address both concepts in one bill, and we chose to take them separately because we wanted to make sure that at least one of them passed. Thanks to them, we've got it very, very good. The bill sits here in Ways and Means.
Okay.
So the future, we're looking at the effectiveness of the collection tools, like Steve said. We're currently looking at how we can make ourselves better, how we can use collection analytics. As more data comes into Gentax, as it's more and more original and not converted data, we're able to make smarter decisions and prioritize debts better to help increase collections. So we are also very interested in helping taxpayers provide self-service as much as we possibly can.
Representative Gumberg.
Were you finished?
Yes, Mr.
All right, I just wanted to ask questions. I've got one final question, Mr. Chair, and I'm watching the clock, but I forgive me for ending on a difficult question, and I'll be happy to take the answer from anybody who feels appropriate to answer it, but it's a self-awareness question, because we've just heard a great presentation with details and organization and based on working with good people, and I recognize that and I appreciate that. So that's what I've got on one hand, and on the other hand, we've had a conversation about vacant positions and the amount of collectible debt and a series of state audits. And my question is, if you were to give yourself a grade on how we're doing on this collection issue, a grade for the last biennium, what would that grade be?
Hi, Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Gomberg, I would not want to venture a guess at that. I would leave that to my director. I apologize. So I don't know if you want to... Sorry, I just don't have that.
I get that. Thank you.
You're going to get your answer. Thank you.
Co-Chair Manning, Representative. Honestly, I'm not comfortable grading on the last biennium. I am fairly new here. I can say that we do have a very talented staff. We have a very committed staff. I think we all agree that there's work to do. And I hear from this body that there's work to do. We're hearing from the governor's office that there's work to do. So irrespective of where we've been in the past, there is some work to do, and we've got to look toward the future. And so with that, you can anticipate plans from us to do better in the future.
Mr. Chairman, that's a good answer. Speaking for myself, and I suspect for the entire committee, we want you to be successful.
Thank you. We want
you to be successful for your agency and for the entire state.
Yes, mm-hmm. Agreed.
Okay.
Co-Chair, if I may have just one more word.
Please, go
Thank
ahead.
Thank you. There was a reference from Senator Johnson about reluctance on our approach to the public, the cyber shaming, I think we've coined it. And I just want to reiterate, there really isn't much reluctance on our part to meet the objectives of this committee and meet the objectives of the state. I think if you do see reluctance, we just want to make sure we get it right. And there are so many considerations that we as department staff have to make or have to consider when we're taking some of these actions that are clearly relevant, that we give pause before we respond.
I appreciate that, and I want to offer back to you, make us your partners. If you think you need statutory adjustments, if you need additional fangs in your collection, whatever you need, make us your partners, because I agree, we all do, with Representative Gomberg. We don't want you to be successful. We need you to be successful.
Understood. And I'll go a step further. I think we're compelled to give you that information at this point. I think the level of interest and the dire straits that we're in financially require that we become partners.
Cool.
So I think we're all on the same page.
Okay, with that being said, we will adjourn and reconvene on Monday at 1500 hours, 3 o'clock, civilian time. We are adjourned.
Thank you.
Civilian time, we are adjourned.
Thank you.